Welcome, and thank you for standing by. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. This call is being recorded. If you have any objections, you may disconnect at this point. I will now turn the meeting over to your host, Michael Milstein. You may begin when ready.
Thank you, Erin, and thanks for joining us today. I'm Michael Milstein, Public Affairs Officer for NOAA Fisheries on the West Coast. Next week, Tuesday, February 1st, the research ship Shimada will leave Port Angeles, stopping in Ketchikan on the way to the remote North Pacific Ocean. That's where the scientists aboard are going to search for many of our familiar Alaska and West Coast salmon, joined later by ships from Canada and Russia. The ocean, of course, is where salmon go from the smolts the size of your finger to adults larger than your leg, and it's important to know what drives that process. So today we have the two chief scientists for the two legs of the Shimada mission, as well as Mark Saunders, who's from International Year of the Salmon, which organized the overall expedition. So I'm first going to introduce Lori Whitecamp. She's a research fish biologist with NOAA Fisheries Northwest Fisheries Science Center in Newport, Oregon. Lori.
Thank you, Michael. As Michael mentioned, salmon spend part of their life in freshwater and part of their life out in the ocean. And in fact, most of their life is actually spent out in the ocean, where they're moving large distances, feeding, growing, becoming these large fish that return several to perhaps 5 or 6 years later. And we've really seen huge influence of ocean conditions on salmon returns in recent years, especially since roughly 2015 with the advent of the warm blob and marine heat waves. You may have noticed in the news or other reports, or perhaps you fish yourselves, for example, Oregon Coast coho, Columbia River coho have been up, whereas other populations, Snake River steelhead, have really gone down and gone down and gone down, causing emergency closures of fisheries. At the ocean, we believe most of that variation is caused by the ocean. It is the most influential and variable stage of the life cycle, but it's also one we know the least about. When salmon especially leave coastal areas and head out into the high seas, they more or less enter a black box. We don't really understand where they are, what they're doing, how much prey is available to them, competitors, etc. And this ocean phase is also the hardest to study. It requires that we use big ships. The fish are very widely dispersed, so we will be fishing for an hour at a time with these large trawls, and we expect to catch anywhere between zero and a handful of salmon. And needless to say, the weather is rather rough. And I think it really requires a collaborative effort to understand what drives salmon in the ocean, their survival, especially with increasing variation caused by climate change, and undertaking international efforts such as these. Salmon don't pay attention to international boundaries, and we fully expect to catch chum salmon from Japan, Russia, Alaska, British Columbia, and Washington all together out there. And the winter, so it's going to be really rough. We were expecting to see some really horrible seas, conditions that really make it difficult to work, but there hopefully will be some days that it's good. We can get a lot of work done and come home with a lot of new data that will really help us understand what's going on out in the ocean. With that, I'll turn it back to you, Michael.
Okay, great. Thanks, Lori. Now I'm going to turn over to Ed Harvey. He's a research fish biologist with our Alaska Fishery Science Center in Juneau. He and Lori are, again, the two chief scientists of the Shimada mission, and then we'll hear a little bit about the big picture, and then you can ask questions. So, Ed, go ahead.
All right, thanks, Michael. As Lori mentioned, the climate variability has varying impacts on salmon populations, and a lot of that impact is happening in our marine environment. I'm up in Juneau, and Alaska populations have been fluctuating recently. We had a large marine heat wave, as Lori mentioned, in the Gulf of Alaska the past 8 years, and that impacted salmon returns to a lot of the regions around the Gulf of Alaska. And more recently, that heat moved up into the Bering Sea, and particularly in the northern Bering Sea, and we're seeing some real differential impacts from that heat. For example, I think many of you understand there was a collapse of chum salmon to the Yukon River this year. However, Bristol Bay sockeye returns are at record highs, and these salmon are distributed very far apart in their early life history, but they do have different regions that they migrate in the ocean. For example, we've got Yukon River chum salmon do spend winter in the Gulf of Alaska. However, Bristol Bay sockeye salmon, when they leave the coastal environments, they spend their winters south of the Aleutian Chain and in the extreme west portion of the Gulf of Alaska. And so that's why these surveys in the winter are extremely important. We know that they're, as Lori mentioned, there are a lot of intermingling of other stocks and species out in winter from all around the Pacific Rim. And so the questions we're asking are what are the conditions that they're experiencing during winter? Are they experiencing any sort of competition at sea? And so this is where our surveys come in. We're going to be collecting information on the physical environment. We're also going to get information on the food web, and we're going to be providing information on stock-specific movement of salmon, because we have genetic techniques that we'll be using. And when we collect the salmon, we'll determine what the genetic stock composition is back at the lab. And what we're also planning to do is put together a pilot project. We've got a uncrewed vessel that the University of Alaska Fairbanks is going to be piloting out in the ocean near where the Shimada will be sampling during winter. We hope to be able to utilize that uncrewed. It's a glider, so it can go from surface down to about 200 meters. It'll be taking information on the oceanography, and it has an acoustic device that one of our colleagues from the University of Washington will be using. So we're going to be collecting information on backscatter in the ocean and comparing some of that information to what we're finding on the Shimada. And maybe some of these new technologies then can be used when we can't get ourselves out on ships in the winter in the high seas. So I think I'll stop there. I'll turn it back to you, Michael.
Thanks, Ed. All right. And finally, Mark Saunders is the Pacific Region Director for International Year of the Salmon, which put together the overall expedition, and will give us a little taste of the big picture. Mark?
Yeah, thank you very much, Michael, and thanks to Lori and Ed, and pleased to be able to speak to the media, U.S. media today. As Michael said, I'm with the International Year of the Salmon, which is an initiative of the North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission. We're out of Vancouver, British Columbia, but we're an international organization established by treaty to protect salmon in the North Pacific Ocean from high seas drift net fishing. Members of our treaty include Canada, the United States, Japan, Korea, and Russia. And I think one of the people like Lori and Ed, scientists, have been working together for years. But as they pointed out, the climate change that we're seeing now, the impacts are severe. And it's not just on Canada and the United States. It's on salmon really throughout the Northern Hemisphere, but certainly experienced dramatic shifts even in areas of the North Pacific that have been historically high, such as in Russia. So the timing is really now to begin to understand this. And the complexity of the questions, as Ed and Lori pointed out, where you're in winter and you're in the high seas, it's not something that just one country can take on. And that's probably part of the challenge, in that there really hasn't been a solid research effort on this life history stage of salmon for decades. And Ed pointed out that we now have DNA techniques that allow us to, when we find a fish in the high seas, to link it back to its watershed of origin, which is new. So we can start to, if we can understand where these fish are in the open ocean, we can start to link it to understanding to management systems and to management actions in freshwater that will need to know what the potential fate for these animals are under a changing climate. So we're trying to understand their distribution. So this is this is probably the boldest, most expansive survey of salmon and probably the oceanography of the open ocean in the North Pacific that's ever taken place. We've got four ships, a Canadian vessel, the Shimada that you've heard about today, a Russian vessel that will conduct about 150 days of survey time in the central and western North Pacific Ocean, which will include American scientists on board. It will cover about 155 stations. So these stations are approximately 60 nautical miles apart. So it's a big ocean and they're covering huge distance. We've had over 60 scientists over 14 areas of research, whether it's understanding the physical oceanography, plastics, micro and macro plastics. We have partnerships and scientists looking at that. Right through to, as Ed was pointing out, some of the DNA sampling and understanding which fish are there and their conditions and testing some of these technologies. We've been planning this for several years. The overall cost is in terms of in-kind with, as you can imagine with these ships, it's an expensive endeavor. So our best estimate right now is around $10 million to execute this expedition. And what did it take to do this? This is one of the biggest challenges is how to do this across countries, and really the success is due to partnership. We've got over 10 different partners that would include government agencies like National Marine Fisheries Service, the NOAA, Canadian Department of Fisheries and Oceans, and from each of the governments, Canada, United States, Japan, and Korea. But we also have extensive funding provided by the North Pacific Research Board and a Canadian research fund called BC Salmon Restoration and Innovation Fund. So academic partners, industry partners have all been part of this. And so without the input of these international scientists and the contributions of these partners in making this a reality, this kind of work doesn't happen. Some people have asked us, how do we determine where we're going? And Ed pointed out that we've got populations in the Gulf of Alaska, in the middle of the ocean, that are from all countries around the Pacific Rim. So we need to study them there. But they're generally our historic, our older data tell us that there's a temperature range that they are in, and that helps define where they've been and that historic work as well. So thinking about, what's going to happen after this expedition, and we've got over two, it'll be in April that we're seeing the final ships returning back to their home ports. But we will be providing, upon their arrival back, a very high-level description of where those ships went and what they provided. And I should say you'll be able to follow on the website where each of these ships is going, tracking them daily in the North Pacific, so you can get an idea of how it's progressing. In early to late May, we will have detailed cruise reports of the general observations that can be summarized. And then, as you can imagine, we'll go into probably a year to 2 years of analysis of laboratory and other results, but we expect some more detailed preliminary analyses to start become available as our International Year of the Salmon wraps up in Vancouver with a concluding symposium in the first week of October 2022. And I guess finally I'll just say, so how do we think these results are going to be used? I think ultimately they're going to start to help us improve our understanding over the long term in the North Pacific. we have a follow-up project through the UN Decade of Ocean Science, that this information will allow us to plan, and that plan will cover through the years through 2030, with the expectation that we can develop an intelligence system that allows us to link our observations in the North Pacific Ocean to the management decisions that need to be made coastally. This will inform annual management processes of forecasts, but as well as things like vulnerability assessments of what climate change means to the salmon and to coastal communities. So we're excited about this bold expedition, and thank you for the opportunity to speak to you, and I'll turn it back to Michael now. Thanks.
Great. Thanks so much, Mark. We appreciate it. Okay, let's see if we have questions.
Thank you. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. To withdraw your request, you can press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. Speakers, please stand by for the first question. Speakers, our first question comes from Linda Mapes, Seattle Times. Your line is open.
Hi, everyone. Thanks for being on the call today. Really exciting. My question is if you could just sharpen a little bit your explanation of why in winter. I mean, there's always a suite of salmon out there in the Pacific any time of year mixing around. So what's special about winter? We know how hard it is, but what is the unique promise of research of this kind in the winter high seas? What's happening then that's different from any other time that makes it such a necessary time to get out there and look?
Lori, do you want to take that?
Sure, I can answer that. So there's what we think of as what we call critical periods. These are times in the ocean residency when there's a lot of mortality, and it's largely influenced by environmental variation. We know that the first summer is one of these first critical periods. When you get a little tiny fish entering the ocean, it's really critical that they grow like crazy, so that they can evade predators, whether they're birds or marine mammals or other fish. And so there's this kind of critical period when they initially enter the ocean. And then the hypothesis has been that there's actually a second critical period that occurs in winter. And it's because in the winter, there's not a lot to eat. And the ocean is very well mixed. It's like one big washing machine out there. And so, you know, any prey that might be there are really dispersed in three dimensions. And so it's a really tough time to make it. And the idea is that if salmon not only aren't growing enough to put on size during that first summer, but they're also not putting enough energy on so that they can make it through the first winter, then that's a reason why you could have a lot of mortality in the winter. And in fact, we were out there in 2019 in the Gulf of Alaska in the winter. We were out in from the middle of February to the middle of March, and we saw a lot of really, really skinny chum salmon. Mm-hmm. They looked like they were starving to death. They had empty stomachs. They were skinny. They really didn't look like they were in great shape, but those were the survivors. And so in this case, in 19, it was like, yeah, these guys have just barely made it through. So that we see this winter as a, you know, it's just like us humans, if we couldn't go to the grocery store, you know, how much food do you keep stored? Our ancestors who lived a little more primitive life, you have to have those stores to make it through. And so that's really what the interest is in winter. And it's just that there's been a lot of research during the summer out in the high seas, not so much on winter for good reason, because it's not a great place to be.
Gotcha. And just to follow on to that, anyone who could explain a little bit more about what you'll actually be doing out there, how deep will the trawl go? How far offshore will you be? What's kind of give people a sense of your movements? Maybe they're quite variable, but if there's anything you could add to that, that would be helpful.
Yeah, so I think our maximum distance from shore is probably going to be about 800 miles, something like that. We're a long ways out there. We'll be down as far south as 47 degrees north, but if you draw a line from 47, which is just south of Seattle, and you go up to Kodiak, the west side of Kodiak, that's our westernmost line, and we're sampling from 47 all the way up to just outside the continental shelf. At each station, we do three things. One is we send down a meter that measures things like temperature and salinity and oxygen and all kinds of stuff. We will be sending that down to either 500 meters or 1,000 meters at some sites, and this is for understanding the physical oceanography. You can look at currents, water column properties, nutrients, et cetera. We'll also be sampling zooplankton, so krill and copepods, that kind of little stuff. And then we have a big trawl that will tow behind the boat. And that, correct me if I'm wrong, Ed, but I believe the opening is 25 to 30 meters deep, so fairly large net that, again, will be towing for about an hour at 5 knots, which is covering a lot of ground, basically five-mile swaths with this net.
Gotcha. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks. Can we go to the next question?
And our next question comes from Marjorie Bauman, Fisherman's News. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. You just partially answered my question with a mention that you're going to be looking at zooplankton and other types of food. Excuse me. But overall, along with checking for the presence of the fish, how much data are you going to be collecting on food sources and the presence of predators? I guess a lot of us are curious that as the climate changes, how the predator-prey relationship is changing as well as the food source presence. Thank you.
Ed, do you want to take that one?
Sure. Food source, as Lori mentioned, we are going to be collecting information through the water column on nutrients, and we are going to be utilizing a bongo net to collect information on zooplankton. And in our trawl, we will also collect small fishes such as mctophids and other squid, typically at night. So that's also prey for salmon. And when we look at the predators, you know, our net does not catch a lot of potential salmon predators, but we do have a group coming out that will be taking water samples for environmental DNA. And through the 2019 winter survey and other surveys that we've had, we note that this eDNA sampling is very effective at identifying presence, absence of either marine mammals or salmon sharks that have maybe been there just a few hours or within the vicinity that, you know, we did not capture in our net, but are there, that are present. And so this is exciting work because predation in winter is considered to be, could be substantial, but we can't really get a handle on that because we never really have done any really good job on measuring predators. But that's where this eDNA will come in and help us with that.
Thanks, Ed. Are there any other questions?
Speakers, at this time, there are no additional questions in queue.
Can you just remind everybody how to ask questions to make sure everybody gets a chance?
Yes, of course. If you would like to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. To withdraw your request, you can press star 2. Again, to ask a question, please press star 1 at this time. And speakers, we did have some queue up. We have a question coming from Linda Mapes. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm curious how people can follow you along. I'm wondering what sorts of links or whatever you might be offering so that people can follow along on the cruise, and will you be putting out reports from the sea?
Mark, do you want to give us
Thank you, Michael. Thank you, Linda, for the question. Yes. So yearofthesalmon.org is the website for our International Year of the Salmon program, and on that site, you will be directed pretty much, I think, on the home page to a page for the 2022 expedition. What you'll find on there is There will be a, it will go live probably probably mid next week, a graphic that will show you where the ships are so you can zoom in, and it will also have a snail trail so you can see where they've been. So hopefully by the middle of next week, you'll be able to watch the Shimada as she transits north. And we have the Russian vessel Tinro leaving Vladivostok next, I think, the end of next week as well, and you should be able to watch it as it transits to Dutch Harbor. We will also include on that website, you can also see a description of the expedition itself, a graphic showing where all the stations are located, and there'll be a connection to links to social media that are there as well. So we'll be posting we expect to have a feed from each ship approximately every 3 days saying where it's been. We'll know where it's been, but what their salmon catches have been, and any notes of interest that they want to pass along. And so we'll, as well as we have capability to get decent quality video, stills and some video. And so every 3 days we expect to get a feed from each ship. And so we will have the ability on the website for you to see the most recent posts and pick them up if you're interested as well. So we do have you can get a hold of us through the website, and we're happy to, if you want to work more closely with us on some specific outreach or investigative work that you might like to do, a story that you want to follow. We do have communications staff, and we're happy to work with you on that.
Great. Thanks, Mark. And we're also setting up a NOAA page on this that will be linked to the International Year of the Salmon as well. Okay, can we go to the next question?
The next question comes from Bellamy Pelthorpe, KNKX. Your line is open.
Hi, thanks. I was dropped from the call for a bit, so forgive me if I'm asking something that's been partially answered already. But, I mean, just given that this is a black box that the salmon go into, if we could get just a little bit more explicit description or listing of what are some of the questions, specific questions that you're trying to answer with the sampling, and how might the sampling actually answer those questions? What is it? What is the big mystery that we're trying to solve?
Lori, do you want to start with that?
Sure. So one of the big questions, and I should say that it's a black box in the sense that our understanding is pretty sketchy. There have been cruisers out there in the past. The U.S. actually did a bunch of cruises across the high seas in the 50s and 60s, and there's been more recent work by the Canadians and even the Russians and Japanese in the area. One of the problems with sampling at that time is that to understand where the fish that you caught came from, either it had to have a tag in it already, like a coated wire tag, which they put on mainly hatchery fish when they leave the hatcheries, you could have a tag so you know where it came from, or they would actually tag fish and then release them and then hope that it survived and somebody caught it somewhere and you could tell where it went to. And so the number, you don't encounter a lot of fish out there anyway, but our understanding of what stocks are where out in the ocean, how they're distributed, is really pretty poor because, you know, most of the fish weren't tagged or you couldn't get them back. And that one of the really powerful things with the new genetic baselines that we have around populations around the Pacific Rim is that now any single fish, we can take a little fin clip and we know exactly where it came from. So for the first time ever, especially with all these ships out there covering this huge area, we'll be able to say exactly where stocks are distributed, how they're distributed across the North Pacific. Which is really, really valuable because even if you're not out there actively sampling, if you see something like a heat wave, you can say, yes, my stock is probably in the middle of that, or no, my stock isn't there. I don't, you know, where my stock is good. It's nice and cold water, what have you. And then the other thing that we're really looking at is just how are these fish doing? Are they getting enough to eat? Does it look like they're starving? Is there a lot of prey available for them? Are there lots of competitors? Who else are they hanging out with? And as Ed mentioned, with the eDNA, we can look and see the incidence of potential predators out there, whether they're salmon, sharks, porpoises, or what have you. So it's really trying to understand the entire ecosystem that supports salmon in the winter, because our understanding is really, really poor at this point.
Ed, did you want to add anything?
I think Lori covered a lot of it, and you know, just getting at the, I think at the direct question as to, well, what are we collecting? And so we're going to have salmon through our rope trawl. We're going to bring them on board, and we're going to take tissue samples. Those tissue samples are going to go back to our laboratories, and they're going to determine the amount of fat that's in the salmon. They're going to look at the energetic status. They're going to be able to look at stock-specific information through genetics. And with that information and understanding that we're in an ocean that is has a mixed stock and mixed species environment during winter where our prey conditions are low, and we really believe that this is when the most stress is occurring on salmon, where competition may among stocks and even species may be occurring. We have information that may lead to that, and we can get it answering some of those questions. How healthy are the fish based on the laboratory analysis from the samples that we bring back? Is competition an issue at this point? Is there enough prey out there? Should we be worrying about, you know, production of salmon either through hatcheries or other means? You know, those are the kinds of questions that the winter surveys can really get at. And since this is a critical period, we really think these are the important ones that we need to address.
Great, thanks. Erin, do we have any other questions?
We do have a question coming from Marjorie Bauman, Fisherman's News. Your line is open.
Yes, thank you. I'm wondering where we can access the summary reports from 2019-2020. I'm looking on the Year of the Salmon, and they are giving a description of what each of these research expeditions were, but I can't find the summary reports on what they found. Thank you.
Any of you know where those are? Otherwise, I can follow up with Margie afterwards.
Yeah, it's Mark here. They should be on that site, but maybe finding them is not easy. I can check into that. If they're not there, they will be on our North Pacific Anadromous Fish Commission site. If you can't find them, we need to rectify that. So, we'll get on that one.
Okay. Yeah, Margie, yeah. I'll follow up to let you know.
I appreciate that. Yeah, Linda Mapes asked my other question, so thank you.
She's good at that. Okay, do we have any other questions?
There are no additional questions in queue at this time.
Okay, well, let's see, do we...
I'm so sorry to interrupt. We did have one more queue up if you have time to take it.
Sure.
All right, it is from Linda Mapes with Seattle Times. Your line is open.
Thank you, Lori, and whoever else might want to address this. I think one of the most interesting things about this to bring out for the public is that these fish go to specific places in the ocean. I think most people don't understand that and wouldn't guess it. They think these salmon squirt out of the rivers and they go randomly around the ocean and circle around for a while and then come back. And apparently that's not the case. Certain stocks go certain places. That's where they go. And they don't go somewhere else. That's their hood. That's where they are. And so the circumstances of that place are relevant to their survival, as Lori was just describing. Could you talk about that a little bit more? I mean, we don't think about salmon as being on roads or in neighborhoods. We think of them as being, quote unquote, out in the ocean somewhere randomly circling around. And apparently that's not how it is.
Yeah, thanks. It is really interesting, and there was some work back in the 60s and 70s when they first proposed that salmon use these what we call ancestral feeding routes, and that they're, like you're saying, they're going to specific places in the ocean. And we shouldn't be surprised if you look at caribou or, you know, large terrestrial mammals, wildebeest in the Serengeti, you know, they do the exact same thing. And it works because over thousands of generations, if you go to these places at the particular times, then it's successful. You're able to reproduce your kids, if it's hardwired, do the exact same thing. And that I think is really what we have found in the last 20 years with both extensive tagging programs like the coated wire tag system, where they're releasing 100,000 tags every year. And now with genetics, we found that if you look carefully at where each individual stock is going, whether they're juveniles, the young fish when they first entered the ocean, or how adults are making their way back home, that each stock does it slightly differently. And so they have these very specific routes that they're taking. We really don't understand or yet don't know how they're distributed later in life, in the ocean life, on the high seas. For example, in 2019, we were out in the Gulf of Alaska in the winter, and then we were on a Russian ship. And when the Russian ship left and went back across the North Pacific to get back to Vladivostok, they stopped and sampled every couple hundred miles, put their net in the water, and lo and behold, they actually caught Fraser River sockeye salmon. Fraser River is in Canada. It's the major river that flows through Vancouver, British Columbia. That's one of the bigger sockeye populations in the world. And we found that they were actually further west across the North Pacific than anybody had ever realized. And so part of the challenge, or one of the things we would like to do with this, is really try and find out, where are they? You know, where, what is it? And the really big kind of $64 million question is, are they following these ancestral feeding routes and ignoring kind of what they're finding, if it's, you know, a good place to be or a bad place to be, or are they responding to things like food availability and temperature? And I should say the data that we have from very early in the marine life and late in the marine life suggests that they really are hardwired for these tracks. And so the question then becomes, as our oceans get warmer or we're having these heat waves where the productivity is really, really low, are they going to these areas that really aren't great places to be, or are they going to start changing their behavior or be a little bit more responsive? So there's kind of this balance between, you know, where their brains or genes are telling them where to go, and then whether that's a good thing or not, and where that, if that's where they ought to be. And I think our understanding on the high seas of that is really incomplete at this point, just because we don't have enough fish. We haven't been able to say, you know, this is the distribution of this stock out in the ocean, and this is what it looks like this year and next year and the year after that, you know, despite just normal natural variation in ocean conditions. So it will be very, very interesting. We can compare what we find here to historic data where they've, you know, written down what the temperature and the salinity was where they found those fish. We can look and see, is it the same? Are they really, you know, within a relatively narrow temperature range, or are they just at a geographic location and that's where they want to be? So it's really exciting and you know, one of these big puzzles that we don't know what the answer is yet, but I'm hoping we'll find out.
All right. Let's see. Do we have maybe time for one last question?
All right. Our next question comes from Casey Mahaffey, clearing up in Northwest Fish Letter. Your line is open.
Thank you. And thank you all for putting this on. It's very, very interesting expedition. And I just was wondering, and I'm sorry if this was asked before, I also got dropped for a minute there. Can you tell me what the main things you learned so far from your expeditions in 2019 and 2020 and how that informed this expedition, what to do on this expedition?
I will start that.
Yeah,
and then Ed can jump in. Like I mentioned, one of the things we learned was these distributions of where salmon were. In 19, we're also able to use genetics and look and see where the fish were, and that really was really phenomenal. We also looked at the condition of the fish, and we were finding all these skinny chum salmon. And what was really amazing is that, you know, there would be these really skinny chum salmon, but at the same time, in the same toe of the net, we got these sockeye that were fat. I mean, you could literally see the subcutaneous fat. If you opened them up, you can see visceral fat on the guts. It's like, where were you guys that were so different? Some of the big lessons I think we learned in 2020 had a lot of problems with weather, much more so than we did in 1919. We were really incredibly fortunate to have really good weather, and that really wasn't an issue. In 2020, that was not the case. But some of the things that they did learn were that these fish are moving around. So a lot of our ideas for, you know, kind of how we're studying the ocean come from the Russians. So the Russians for the last 30 years have been doing winter surveys, late winter surveys. They've really figured out where their fish are, and they go out and they go sample them, and they can tell what the condition is, what do they look like, and they use that information to help forecast the returns. And so the Russian data suggests that these fish really aren't moving around very much, that they're, you know, kind of hanging out, doing their thing, feeding, growing, whatever, in the end of winter before they start making their way home. And in 2020, I think one of the really interesting things was that they were able to repeat sample some of the stations several weeks later and got a really, really different fish community when they resampled with different species of salmon and also non-salmon. And so it suggests that maybe it's a little bit more dynamic than some of the Russian literature. And it's hard to tell because the Russians are mainly catching pink salmon. We've got coho and chinook and sockeye and other stuff, other species out here. And, you know, I think one of the big things to come out of it as well is just that international cooperation works. We had, you know, people from all the MPAFC nations on the survey in 2019. I can't speak for 2020, but it was really incredible to be out with our compatriots that were from other nations that, you know, Kiko-san, who's been a Japanese fish biologist for longer than I have, which is a long time, and to be able to just talk to him and have lots and lots of time to sit down and describe each other's view of what we think is going on out in the ocean and realize that their views are a little different and where are the similarities, where are the differences, et cetera. It was really a unique opportunity to be immersed into living and breathing with these people for a month and learning about how they view the world. So I it's not really scientific, but I think it's really important for future collaborations like this one that we're now pulling off. Ed, do you want to add to that?
Sure, Lori, thanks. So one thing to keep in mind is it's really interesting and important that we sample in varying ocean conditions if we want to learn more about salmon ecology and the marine environment. And we know that in 2019 that it was anomalously warm. We had a heat wave in the Gulf of Alaska. So we are very fortunate to have a winter survey out there at a time when we know there was probably a lot of impact on the food web and on the condition of the salmon. And in 2020, we do have information out there that the temperatures were moderating. And now that we're moving into this year, we should get a real contrast then to be able to compare what we saw from 19 when we had a real heat wave to maybe more moderate temperatures in 20 to maybe something that might look more what we would consider a quote unquote normal this year. I know that, you know, from my experience with working up in the Bering Sea, when we've seen anomalous events and we see shifts in distributions and changes in ecosystems, and it's been through extreme, you know, anomalies that we really start to learn how ecosystems will respond and how fish will also respond. So that's that's driving, you know, this next expedition. We will be sampling in that same area of the Gulf, but again, this is Pan-Pacific now, so we are broadening that expanse clear down to the south of the Aleutian Chain and covering the entire Gulf. So it's an amazing effort. I really look forward to getting out there. Thanks.
All right. Let's take one last question.
All right. Our last question comes from Bellamy Pelthorpe, KNKX. Your line is open.
Oh, yeah. I just wanted to hear a little bit more about the timeline of this. So I see that it's a five-year effort, and it sounds like 2018 was maybe gearing up, and then you had expeditions in 19 and 20, and now this year, you know, what's the future look like for all of this?
Yeah, it's Mark here, Michael. I can answer that. Yeah, thank you for the question. It was. Yeah, so the International Year of the Salmon was a little broader than the expeditions, but certainly the expeditions are one of the biggest pieces of it. And I should acknowledge Drs. Dick Beamish and Brian Riddle, who privately did most of the fundraising, and Dick was actually some of the initial ideas, the idea for an International Year of the Salmon, and they did the work on 19 and 20 with our assistance and engagement and people like Lori participating. And it's kind of culminated in this bigger effort that was actually the design was initially the Russians putting it forward. And as Lori pointed out, they have a long history of doing this ecosystem work, which I find just so fascinating. Lori we work with a young Russian scientist, Alexei Somov. And he will have been in all three expeditions, and he's marvels at the differences between the Western North Pacific and the Eastern, and he's part of that exciting kind of new cadre of young scientists and older scientists that we're bringing together on this. The International Year of the Salmon, yes, it went for 5 years and 18, and was more in the planning stages, and this was one of our biggest priorities, was to get back into the high seas, not just for the science observations that we were going to make, but also, as Lori says, to build the relationships. This has been the purview of sort of senior scientists that over the last couple decades were able to develop strong scientific relationships across between countries. And now we're sort of bringing it to all the, you know, right across the organization, young scientists, old scientists, being able to do it. So that's a really big part of it. So that was part of our priority, and to get back into the high seas. We had other, what might seem like more mundane issues, but sharing data is so important to understand what's going on. And we've sort of learned to share, looking at new technologies and developing the ability to share data, not just on salmon, but on the ecosystem across the Northern Hemisphere. So we've had a very big data mobilization piece. And as well, we're trying to bring together a more holistic approach to going from understanding across all of these life history stages and how it can inform a more holistic view of what's taking place in our salmon, with our salmon. We spend a lot of money in the lower 48 and Canada on restoration of habitat. And if we don't understand what it's going to take, what the fate of these fish are in the ocean, we can spend a lot of money and effort in areas that may not be the best way to spend our money. So really important as we manage salmon across its life cycle that we develop this more holistic understanding. So we've been working with these problems are the same in the Atlantic, and we're trying to build the ability to link the Atlantic and researchers and managers across broader geographies and to be able to work together. And so I mentioned earlier that our next project that we're scoping right now and got endorsed by the United Nations Intergovernmental Oceanographic Commission is a project called BECCE, Basin Events to Coastal Impacts, which will build what we hope coming out of this using this expedition and the two previous ones as kind of baseline data and understanding about how these systems work and how people can work together to build the equivalent of an intelligent system that gives us much timelier way our understanding of what's happening, how the ocean is influencing salmon on scales of days and annual forecast to projections out with climate. And so we're excited about that next step that's probably going to be an order of magnitude bigger than this project, which is pretty big as it is. So I'll stop there, Mike.
Great. Thank you, Mark. I think that will do it for us today. Thank you all for calling in and the good questions. We really appreciate it. If you have any follow-up questions or want to contact the scientists or follow up, you can contact me, Michael Milstein, 971-313-1466, or my email is michael.milstein@noaa.gov. And we will look forward to updates from the field and sharing those with you. And again, if you want to follow up or stay in touch with the survey, it's International Year of the Salmon website, or contact me and I can point you in the right direction. With that, I think we'll close the call.
Thank you, speakers. That concludes today's conference. Thank you all for participating. You may now disconnect and have an amazing day.